real pleasure. My name is Barbara Park, and I'd like to welcome you to Prairie Unitarian Universalist Society this morning. We have, I'm sure, a real treat to look ahead this morning, because I've always enjoyed Barbara Raines' program. And you're lighting the chat, Barbara. The kids are downstairs, by the way, this morning, being the first of the month.
I'm asking you to read the lighting of the chalice with me. We light the chalice today in gratitude for the spoken words and written words that inspire and invigorate us and countless others long after the speakers and writers are gone.
Share our joys and sorrows.
Or about the last year, I wrote a book. And last week, I signed a contract with a publisher in Vermont. Well, especially appeal to those of you who work with chainsaws. it's a narrative book about the work that Marsh and I do, and included in that is a lot of information on chainsaws and safe tree felling and things like that.
Sure. Yeah. This is the woodsman in you that this book is.
Well, there's a tentative title. The publisher titles it. And it's going to be all about chainsaws and a lot about sawmills and heating with wood also.
That's a long time.
But we want to attract all buyers again.
Others?
Well, I have one. Okay, after tracing all over the country, I've accepted a job at East Carolina University. Gail this morning that the other person they hired in the two positions is also from UW, not somebody I know real well, but I will get to know.
All this wonderful news on one hand, I'm going to be very sad to know too. And yes, I just want to say I'm pleased to report we do have a due date for my brother's sister and his Easter Sunday.
Oh. So sometime before then, probably we'll be going in.
Suddenly become a snowbird.
Yeah.
Others? I just wanted to say it was both a sorrow and a joy to be here last night for Mike's service. Dean did a wonderful job, and it was really a reflection of our Prairie community losing someone that was so dear to us. And it was very comforting to be here and see all of us together today.
Yeah, for those of you who weren't here, it was, I thought, a very heartwarming, joyous occasion amongst our, there were about 170 people here, flowing over into the kitchen in the hallway. It was very well attended, and many of his co-workers and neighbors and stuff spoke. It wasn't just prayer people getting it, and that it was just a wonderful, broad sharing of all of the aspects of Mike's life and work and personality, and it was beautiful. Appreciate everybody who spoke and everybody who participated one way or another. It was a real community effort. Are there others?
Well, it's a transition. I don't know if it's a joy or a sorrow, but Marilyn decided I should go back to work. Tomorrow morning, I start anew.
Where?
Well, I'm going to be doing something I did a long time ago, and something I'm pretty familiar with, which is operating and training people on the state information systems for the 5142 Community Service Board.
Oh.
Focus on alcohol and drug abuse and that information area.
Any others?
Oh, I'll just share. And I don't know if it ever happened to any one of you before, but last week I received a letter in the mail from the Department of Workforce and Department of Workforce Development encouraging me, asking me and encouraging me to apply for a job as community service specialist, which is sort of nice because I had just recently applied for a job as transportation specialist, which I didn't get, and I filled out a 25-page essay. I got the interview, but I didn't get a job. So then she gets this letter in the mail inviting me and encouraging me to apply for this other job, which I really
did. That's wonderful. Congratulations. Yeah.
Erin won a writing contest for a short story at and weirdly, one of the judges, who is Ron Zaleski from the State Journal Past Times, he was sure that she must have plagiarized it because it was written so well. Very
funny. We're going to sing hymn 273.
So feel free to borrow or even keep. On the other bench over here are two books that I used in the service by A. Paul Davies. One is called The Mind and Faith of A. Paul Davies, and one is called The Language of the Heart, and it's all short prayers. One of the letters that came in response to my note was from Canada, from Toronto. Reverend Gretchen Thompson, you'll see it on the page 3 and, you know, the opposite side. It was in response to the terrific ice storms that crippled the whole Canadian area. She quoted the Montreal minister who said the new Montreal church was so close to an electricity substation that people, they had light and warmth where everybody else didn't. And people just thronged in. I never thought about how electric time machines can't work when you don't have electricity. Gasoline pumps don't work. The Montreal Church is serving others. Well, that explains a little bit of how she wrote her meditation. And she probably spoke it to her congregation, but I'm asking you to read it to one another because it is a unifying one. So read with me.
yearning for a light, a hope, and an awakening, recovery from the ravages of ice and storm, a fervent hope for peace on earth, grateful for the gift of an unexpected child, feeling the need for courage to earn rightly a life at home safe. What needs do you carry through these long dark nights? What gifts do you bring? Where is the source of your courage? Be here with your gifts and your needs. On this morning, be one in the warmth of this community. As we're sitting together now in silence, we share our burdens and we relearn how to dream. We celebrate that we are diverse in geography, diverse in our theology, diverse in our religious practice, but we treasure our connections, the connections which bind us together with assurance that we are not alone.
Yes, March 1st is St. David's Day, and St. David is the patron saint of the Welsh. Though not much is known about him, he never had as good a press as St. Patrick. And when Mike Briggs led our service on epithets, I told you that St. David was called the water drinker by people who probably drank something a lot stronger. You contrast that with St. Patrick's Day. He died about 600 A.D. and formed many churches, mostly in South Wales. And the little town that juts out farthest west in the whole country into the Atlantic Ocean is called St. David's. Welsh people are known for their love of music and poetry and the colorful, forceful use of words. It's not surprising that many preachers have come from that little country, and I want to share with you some excerpts from Unitarian ministers of the past, and I've posted on our walls some contributions by Living Cymru in our ministry today. Another characteristic of the Welsh is the tendency to doubt, to examine what are called truths. So some of the chapels in Wales are called nonconformist. I'll digress to tell you a little story from John Dingley, who was born in Wales. In a terrible storm and shipwreck years ago, a Welsh sailor found that when he managed to reach shore on a rather small island, he was the only human inhabitant. And 25 years passed before another ship came close and someone came ashore. The captain was, of course, amazed to find a human being, but the captain wanted to look around the island a bit, so the sailor walked with him up a gentle slope toward the center. And 25 years, said the captain. What did you do with yourself in all that time? I'll show you, said the Cymru. And at the top, there was a little depression. So they looked down into a little valley, and down there were two Welsh chapels. You made these yourself? Yeah, I did, said the Welshman. But why two, said the captain. Well, you see that one over there? That's the one I don't go to. Outstanding young ministers of our denomination, outstanding among ministers in our denomination in this country, was A. Powell Davies, a young Methodist minister in Wales, who served Unitarian congregations later in Summit, New Jersey, and then in Washington, D.C. Washington, D.C., what an opportunity to speak each Sunday morning to a large congregation that surely included persons whose influence could be felt in small or large measure on public policy. The foreword at the front of the book, and that's one of the books on the piano bench, the foreword was written by Justice William Douglas of the Supreme Court of the United States, and it took 18 and a half pages. He just got out of reading some of his words. Included among the sermons are memorials for Supreme Court Justice Wiley Reynolds, a Baptist, and for Mrs. Hugo Black, wife of a Supreme Court Justice, who was a Presbyterian. Yet Dr. Davies was the one who was asked to do the memorial service. His years in Washington included all the Joseph McCarthy period. So he spoke face to face in private counseling with men and women who had lost employment, lost friends, lost status, and were contemplating suicide. Now, these words are from Justice Douglas. There were many facets to A. Powell Davies. People who knew him will remember him for different traits. By some who came for help, he will be remembered for his wisdom and compassion. For others, the poetry of his written word will survive the longest. Still others will recall his forthright stand on public issues. I had always found in my Presbyterianism a rich heritage of civil rights, and I found the same in his Unitarianism. There was a warm bond between us. I will always remember him best for one of our last talks together. That day, Dr. Davies spoke with deep feeling about censorship. He had been aroused over and again about censorship, once in 1953, when he learned that not only his books, but those of Judge Learned Hand, George Gershwin, and Adlai Stevenson were all banned by the State Department from overseas libraries. There was no place for the censor in his scheme of things. If men committed crimes, they should be punished. There should be no board of review over literature or art. He mentioned these matters to me as a prologue to a recent personal experience. He went into a drugstore in Washington, D.C. to purchase a copy of a religious book. The store had not stocked it. He went to another branch with the same result. He then got hold of the manager, who told him that none of the stores carried the book. Dr. Davies asked the reason. The manager said that the drug chain stocked only those paperback books that were on a list approved by some so-called decency league. This book is a religious book, Dr. Davies said. Do you mean to tell me that you allow a censor to tell you what religious books you can sell? Listen, Dr. Davies, I don't want to get into a religious controversy, the manager remonstrated. Get into a religious controversy, Dr. Davies retorted. You're right in the middle of one. Needless to say, the book was thereafter stopped, and another victory in civil liberties was won by this fiery and lovable man who gave his life for human freedom. Dr. Davies was not a man who went around looking for trouble. But when some grievous injustice came to his attention, he spoke up, dropping his primary concern to deal with the issues of the day. After World War II, we as a people were concerned with getting back to normalcy and getting rid of wartime restrictions. Some of us remember that, don't we? Along with this feeling came a feeling of isolationism. Dr. Davies saw these regressive impulses merging during Thanksgiving in 1945, when America ate more and better than ever before, while 20 million Europeans were destitute and starving. This is a quote from his sermon of that day. We kept Thanksgiving in this country last week, he said from the pulpit. We did indeed. And we polluted and desecrated it. We profaned and violated every decent thing about it. We thank God for the opportunity of gluttony. His congregation was inspired by that one sermon to send over 90 tons of food to the Europeans through UNRWA, that's United Nations Relief and Rehabilitation. When the American witch hunt, and that's Joseph McCarthy's period, was in full cry, people were being investigated not for actions against the state, nor for present associations, but for unwise but innocent past associations. Dr. Davies took to the pulpit one Sunday and said, it is right that former wrongdoing remain hidden when its disclosure would do more harm than good. We are not thinking of crimes which should be expiated or of injuries for which there should be reparation. We are thinking of matters in which the individual concerned can improve his life by learning from his past mistakes. Mistakes which society would taunt him with if they were known, not because he's evil and society good, but because society is vindictive and hypocritical. When the issues were major ones, bearing on moral principles, he spoke up regardless of consequences. To one parishioner, he once wrote, "You are wrong in kindly supposing that there may be necessities to which I must bow. I am not aware of any. I say what I think, and whether congregations grow or decline, I shall doubtless continue to do so, just as I do in this letter. I find it so great a simplification that nothing else is worth bothering about." I've said enough to indicate that Dr. Davies did not hesitate to use the pulpit in the cause of social justice. His religion, as we've seen, was not a thing apart from daily life. It was meaningful to him only as it was applied, and applied realistically. He always felt some degree of success was possible. He once said, "Religion that's not realistic, not practical, that does not enter the arena of public affairs and enter it with importunate energy and relentless purpose is not worth bothering with at all." Born in 1902, educated and ordained in the Methodist ministry in Wales, he had longed to go to America. So 5 months after his marriage, at age 25, he and his wife, also a minister's daughter, crossed the Atlantic to Boston, and he took the pastorate of two little Methodist churches near Biddeford, Maine. The country people were grateful that they had a well-educated, trained minister. When spring came and the country roads were so deep in mud that cars were unable to get through without being stuck, they hired a tractor and pulled their cars to church. Dr. Davies gained a deep respect for the native intelligence and sturdy independence of these New Englanders. In addition to the work of these two parishes, he and his wife found time to take some courses at Boston University. They helped finance the Boston experience by working with the youngsters of a settlement house in Boston in return for a room there. So during the winter of 1928 and 29 rings bells, doesn't it? They spent each week in Boston driving back to their main villages every weekend. There followed 4 years as a Methodist minister in Portland, Maine, still an unconventional minister, speaking widely to civic groups. In 1930, he opened a Portland church nightly to provide food and shelter for homeless men after he had been requested by the police of Portland to make a visit to the jail where men were crowding in from the streets just to keep warm. His change from Methodism to Unitarianism came gradually. He was always an independent preacher, even within the framework of English Methodism. And by the time he reached Portland, he dropped the Apostles' Creed from his services. He became a close friend of Reverend Vincent Solomon, a Unitarian minister in Portland, Maine, who doubtless was instrumental in introducing him to American Unitarianism. It was near the end of his stay in Portland that he decided to apply for fellowship in the American Unitarian Association. It has no creedal test. There he was sure he would find the intellectual and spiritual freedom he had been seeking. There followed 11 years as pastor of the Community Church of Summit, New Jersey. In that time, he became a leader in the movement called Unitarian Advance, getting new vigor into the denomination as a whole. During this same period, he spoke often on international problems. He traveled extensively in Europe before the outbreak of World War II. Returning, he used his pulpit and platform to try to awaken America to its responsibilities. His first book, American Destiny, opened with these words pertinent today: not by design, but by necessity, the American people are moving toward world ascendancy. America, he said, must take the leadership in a world that has become a single, vast, reluctant community. The United States, he said, not only began with a revolution, it is a revolution. And its faith in the freedom of man is the only faith that can unite the world. In September 1944, he was called to be minister of All Souls Church in Washington, D.C. And that church had its greatest growth in those 13 years he served there. And so many people attended that the main church and auditorium could not hold them all. The overflow heard the service on a public address system in an adjoining hall. Under his leadership, 7 new Unitarian congregations were formed in the Washington area. Bob Park tells me that one of these is named Davies Memorial, honoring Dr. A. Powell Davies. He was one of the founders for Americans for Democratic Action. He was chairman of the Emergency Conference for Civilian Control of Atomic Energy, and was president of Food for Freedom. Dr. Davies' parishioners remember him preeminently for his counsel and advice, his tenderness and insight, his vision and his understanding. In his book, and he wrote several, called The Temptation to Be Good, he wrote, "Those who have come to me in their distress, doubting but still believing, wounded but not defeated, showing me how limitless is human possibility, these, above all others, have been my teachers." It's hard to decide which of the sermons to share with you. When I spoke about this to the St. Paul Unitarian Congregation, I read one called Good Character. But because our society has recently expressed a wish to deepen our spiritual lives, I've chosen excerpts from 2 different sermons called Prayer. Many people have discarded prayer because they think it must be petitionary, which they regard, I think correctly, as childish. But the prayers of the saints rose beyond this. They called it meditation, and at a further stage, contemplation. For ourselves, we may wish to call it inner discourse, or reflection at the highest level of which we are capable. It is rash indeed to be disdainful of this discipline. Day after day, we look at life through petty hopes and fears, and often through our prejudices. Should there not be a time each day for looking at it from a higher level? To me, the best time is the end of the day, and that might be the time, I think, for many people, to look back over the day and judge it. Judge it, first of all, severely. The things we said, the truth we didn't speak, the wasted moments of resentment or of foolish pride, the fears we didn't cast out, the fretful aims that possessed us, the same aims that have always disappointed us. Let these and all things else that need it be severely judged. And then let us see what there was of good in the day, and how we could have kept on friendlier terms, not only with the world, but with ourselves. Whether we turn this thinking toward God, or just meditate on it in our hearts, this is prayer, and the power of God is in it. There is a sort of duality in each of us, a discussion within our innermost thoughts. The nobler voice will be said by some of us, myself for instance, to be the voice of God. Not literally, of course, but in source and spiritual vitality. Others of us will call it our better nature, but no matter what he called it, its presence is a firm reality. We cultivate our inner lives and thereby raise the quality of all our living by giving definite time to such a discipline. And to the extent that we see the world more clearly and ourselves and our part in it more plainly, we gain wisdom and sureness of direction. And this, in turn, relieves the tension that would that the world imposes on us, much of which is due to vacillation and uncertainty, and it brings us closer to serenity. It is at this time, of course, this time of prayer or meditation, that we should make decisions. Not generalized decisions which evaporate before the next day's life has been lived for a single hour, but definite and particularized decisions. In dealing with situations which will presently confront us, we should act in this way and not in that. It is thus that we raise the level of our intentions. How could we at such a time excuse low aims? It's also in this way that we dissolve our prejudices. A prejudice reveals itself as such if we think about it when we pray. And quite certainly, to have higher aims and fewer prejudices gives us a growing sense of confidence. Now, the next excerpt is from a sermon on prayer, which you may have seen a bit of in the UU World a few months ago. What do we expect from God? I remember an occasion in England early in my ministry when I was deeply shocked by the belief of a mother that her prayers had saved her son from drowning. The destroyer on which this boy was serving, it happened to be the First World War, was torpedoed and most of the crew perished. But the son of this particular mother managed to survive, owing, she said, to her prayers. Do you mean, I asked, for I was a young minister in those days, with a zeal almost untainted by discretion, do you mean that God saved your boy because you prayed for him and he let all the other boys drown because their mothers were less devout? Of course, she said, surprised at such a question. Then, said I, much too unkindly, you are not Christian. What sort of a God is that? Drowning boys both good and bad if their mothers neglect to pray for them. And saving any kind of a boy provided his mother requests it. The lady was quite upset. For these seemed harsh words coming from a minister. But I've no doubt she was comforted, perhaps by leaving me out of her prayers. And in my case, and in any case, she must have felt quite justified when she learned that I had become a Unitarian. I've had to cut quite a bit. And this is what should be. It is right, both right and necessary. If the universe were ruled by a motherly old man who many imagine to be the paramount deity, an indulgent Santa Claus of a God who is often nice to people who approach him tactfully, the universe would be a joke and human life a childish pantomime. God must at least be great or not be God, and that should always be our starting place. He had a like quarrel with psychiatrists. We hear that what we must do to get peace of mind is to get rid of our conscience. For guilt feelings are not examined to discover whether they indicate the presence of a soul. It is taken for granted that they indicate the presence of a neurosis. Sometimes they do not. They do, but not as often as the shallow diagnoses of modern days would indicate. There should be guilt feelings. Just as the sick body gives warning of its sickness through pain, so does a sick soul. And spiritual opiates are not the answer. They ease the pain only to kill the soul. He died of what the papers called a heart attack, painlessly, at work in his study in his 55th year. But really, it was a pulmonary infarct secondary to thrombophlebitis of the leg veins. He'd been afflicted with phlebitis for several years. I'll end this little glimpse into his life with a short prayer from Language of the Heart, and you're free to borrow either of the books that are there. Be with us, O God, in the quiet self-knowledge that each of us carries in his heart. What we find there that should be rebuked, by thy Spirit give us boldness to rebuke it. What there is that we would be better without, help us to dissolve it away. And what there is of high purpose help us to see it plainly and to build upon it, that the best within us may come to rule our lives until we live as we really want to live, and our deeds are the answer to our prayer. We're going to sing now hymn 115. These are Welsh tunes. The first one was a translation from the Welsh, but this one is words by Harry Emerson Fosdick.
If you get a chance, various points around the state every summer, the Welsh community holds Gymanda Gani, which is hymn singing. But last May, Barbara and I found ourselves sitting together, and this was one of the ones that they did. It went on for about 10 minutes. They give you a hymn book that's in which the words are both in Welsh and English. And they kept repeating the last verse over and over and over. It got better every time. You would not believe the fervor. If there's anybody that's going to sing bass here on this one, end of the top line on the second page, the way the Welsh bassist do this.
It's not in your hymnal, but it's in all the Welsh.
I don't know why they left it out of here. It's supposed to be Unitarian, but I guess I don't know.
Church in Rochester, New York, were in part contemporaneous with Dr. Davies. David Reese Williams was one of the signers of the Humanist Manifesto, and I have a copy of it, that long piece of white, hard to read. And he was a participating member of the American Humanist Association. In one of his books, a chapter is called Honest Agnosticism is a Mark of Reverence. This I'm quoting from his sermon. The word agnostic should not be regarded as an epithet of contempt. The word simply means, I do not know. There are certainly large areas of human interest and inquiry where we must confess our ignorance and doubt if we would be truly frank and honest. The spirit of true reverence, in my judgment, calls for an honest confession of ignorance concerning the great mysteries of life, rather than an unwarranted profession of inside information. On the other hand, we have the disbelieving dogmatists who make just as sweeping denials on insufficient evidence as the former make unwarranted affirmations. How many times have I gone to so-called radical meetings and secular societies and heard speakers make unsupported assertions that there is no God, that there is no intelligence behind the universe, that there is no such thing as life beyond the grave, that life has no meaning, and that all the love and beauty in the world and all the capacities of the human mind are but the accidents of fate, the achievement of happy chance. In my opinion, such sweeping denials go far beyond the little that we know and are just as irresponsible and as unwarranted an attitude as that of the dogmatists who take the opposite point of view. To me, the honest agnostic takes the most defensible position toward all these metaphysical questions. His is neither an attitude of affirmation or denial, but of earnest inquiry. His is the open mind and the disciplined tongue. His is the sincerity of the truth seeker, who makes no pretensions to knowledge when he has none. The attitude which seems to me to be the most reverential in spirit and which holds out to the world the most hope of true religious progress. There are some things, however, which I do know, which are fraught with tremendous significance and about which none of us needs to be agnostic. I know from the experience of others, and some I've had myself, that those people who are the happiest are engaged in some form of creative labor. Men who bring things to pass that never before existed. Women who give birth to children or who mold their minds and characters. Youths who strive to make their dreams come true. I know that there are none so miserable as they who have so little to do that they find time hanging heavy on their hands. I know from the experience of others, and some I had myself, that the committal of one's loyalties and energies to some great cause outside of oneself eventuates in a joy and satisfaction that could come in no other way. I know from the experience of others, and some I've had myself, that words of forgiveness and acts of generosity bring spiritual blessings to ourselves as well as to others. I know that self-respect, the goodwill of friends, and the domestic affections are among the richest possessions that anyone can strive for and acquire. I know that the blood which flows in the veins of all races is of the same color, that black and white and brown and yellow are brothers and sisters of one another, progeny of some common parentage, who owe to one another the sustained consideration becoming to members of one family. I know that warfare and peonage and economic exploitation, retributive punishment, religious intolerance, and all forms of hatred are incompatible with this relationship. I know that there is an infinite life within our own, constantly prompting us to reach out for that which is beyond our immediate grasp, to give ourselves. Own lives and do all we can to discourage those agencies and factors that tend to foster an opposite spirit. Man's love for man, dim lantern that it still is after all the brightest light we have, wherewith to beat back the darkness of the cosmic mystery that surrounds our planetary existence. We're going to turn to 119, another Welsh tune.
Another Welsh tune, they only give half the name of the tune here. It's Ebenezer, so it has an alternate title, which is Tom Importo, which I understand is found in a bottle, and I don't know why it's called that.
I know this story too. It was found in a bottle floating in from the ocean. And they settled on the Wisconsin frontier first, probably on the land we know near Spring Green. Early schooling was meager, but the home was one of religious seriousness and literary culture. He read all the books he could come by, and he dreamed of college while doing the rough farm work. Entered the Civil War not only to save the Union, but to preclude the enlistment of a brother who was a married man. The Artilleryman's Diary, that was a book, his first book, written then, but not published till 1914, when Jones was adamantly opposed to war. In Meadville, Pennsylvania, that's where the Meadville Theological School of our denomination began. The Unitarian Theological School, a visitor described him, a genuine Western boy, unspoiled, uneducated, poor but earnest, persevering, and as bright and keen as you could consider, as you could desire. One of the former students had been expelled from Meadville Theological for maintaining that he did not believe Darwin's Origin of the Species necessarily atheistic. But when Jenkin Lloyd Jones went there, the president was more liberal. The president taught a course in comparative religions, and he said, Muhammad saved some souls as well as Moses. And China has not been a mere desert, blank, a desert of souls. So Jenkins' first charge after his graduation in 1870 was Winnetka, Illinois, at the Liberal Christian Church. And then he went to the First Independent Society of Liberal Christians in Janesville, Wisconsin. He began to publish a periodical called The Sunday School, with emphasis on big changes in classes for children and adults. No catechism-like memorizing. No preachy story lessons. He recommended class discussions and investigations, weekly teachers' meetings, songs that were simpler and less funereal. He wanted the guidance of teachers who read and thought about their subjects. And for adults, he began the Mutual Improvement Club, Education with Social Service and Reform Work. It offered current events, current literature, great art, dramatics, even a Saturday afternoon class for homemakers on modern poetry. There was a predecessor of the Great Books Club in his church. Young people of other denominations were attracted, but Boston's AUA was more conservative and even dropped a New Bedford minister from its ranks because he would not call himself a Christian, only a Unitarian. That same year, the Western Conference ruled that money from the churches should be sent to the Western Conference, not to Boston. Jenkins, with permission of his Janesville church, was made a missionary secretary for the three summer months of the year. His term in Janesville inevitably ran the other 9 months. Never before in the history of the Unitarian movement had anyone worked so intensively on propaganda and organization as did Jones between 1875 and 1880. He was constantly on the road. His three-month contract was honored more in the breach than in the observance. He visited distressed churches, dormant churches, isolated groups of radicals, liberals that aspired to become churches, church societies. The treasury was almost always empty. And to pay for the 9,988 miles he traveled by train or team the first year, he drew upon his own slender salary. He begged congregations for collections to cover his expenses. He sold his watch, pawned his wife's watch, borrowed money from his children's penny savings bank, but go he would when and where an appointment had been announced. To economize time, he always took the last train, in other words, talking to the last minute, whether it was a freight train, a passenger, or a cattle train. When trains were late, he sometimes spent the night on the floor of the waiting room. His annual reports to the Western Conference were so full of optimism and activity, even in Depression years, with grasshopper plagues that ruined whole areas of Kansas and Nebraska, that reading those reports gives one the feeling of marching in a triumphal procession. From 41 active Unitarian societies in 1875, with $100,000 in debt, there were 61 societies, up from 41, in 1880, and the debt was cut in half. But he didn't antagonize the AUA in Boston. In that last year, it allocated $11,500 for the Midwest and Pacific Coast field. In 1 year, 1880, Jenkin Lloyd Jones traveled 14,676 miles. No automobiles, you know. Visited 41 places, gave 78 sermons and addresses, exclusive of his Janesville duties. He felt on the verge of physical bankruptcy at the end of that year, and he felt entitled to a release. But the Western Conference made him missionary secretary, gave him a Chicago office so he could devote his whole time to the work. At the sociable evening that followed this appointment and its announcement, he was given a silver box full of greenbacks. And he responded with a tribute to his wife for her part in the work, so whimsically and tenderly grateful that few of the delegates had dry eyes at its closing. Did ever a denominational official in the history of the American church have so vast a region under his care as did Jones, traveling from Cleveland to Denver, from Duluth to Kansas City, reconciling, exhorting, warning, but always encouraging the brethren, lay and clerical. Yet to these Midwest burdens was added a considerable responsibility for the missions and churches beyond the Rocky Mountains. Hence, a stream of correspondence concerning vacant pulpits, despondent or divided congregations, suitable or unsuitable candidates, came to Jones' desk in Chicago. He worked to salvage from the depression of the 1870s several churches, and he started them off afresh with consecrated and able leaders. In 1878, a new periodical called Unity was begun, and it included Sunday school lessons. Jones' enthusiasm and creativity brightened its pages. In an early article, he wrote, "We liberals, who are working so hard to secularize our public schools, who insist so loudly that religion is the result of slow growth and not of sudden conversion, we who believe that character is the ultimate end of all living and of all study, we who believe in intellectual freedom and know that the air is full of bigotry and error, we of all people have most need of Sunday schools." That's the end of the quote. One of Jones' heroic achievements was a gathering and founding of All Souls Church in Chicago's South Side. The tragic big fire of 1871 and the economic depression of the whole decade had forced the Fourth Unitarian Church of Chicago to sell its building in 1880. A remnant of the membership had kept hoping and praying for a better day, and it finally came November 1882 in a bare, shabby hall furnished with a long table and kitchen chairs. Jones preached "The Ideal Church," was the name of the sermon, to a congregation of about 25 adults and 3 children. His ideal church would be a free congress of independent souls. It is to lead in the campaign for more truth rather than to indolently stand guard over some petty fragment of acquired truth. It will be the thinker's home. The student of science will handle no discoveries that it will not prize and indulge in no guesses that it will not respect. Oldest India and newest America will hold no gem of thought that will not be welcomed into its sacred scriptures. The skeptics will be the cowards that dare not exercise the reason God has given them. Over its portals, no dogmatic test is to be written to ward off an honest thinker or an earnest seeker. The church must emphasize the universal brotherhood. It will stand upon a grand emphasis of the great word of this century, unity. It will seek to welcome low and high, rich and poor, believer and unbeliever. A Sunday school was started immediately. In 1 month, the church was organized, and in another month, a unity club. Rent and expenses were raised by an every member canvas. And at Jones' insistence, the minister's salary was not a fixed one, but a residue left when other expenses had been paid. In 1887, a sunny large building had club rooms and a pastor's residence on its second floor. Hundreds in the Sunday school and in the Unity Club sessions made it necessary in 1888 to buy a parsonage and to move clubs upstairs. There were public reading rooms, a choral club, a women's gymnasium, a free kindergarten, a lens club for camera fans. Trustees insisted on paying the parson Jones at least $3,000 a year. He managed to save enough to buy land on the Wisconsin River. Now that would be the land we know around Taliesin today. I want to mention some of the social action causes that Jenkin Lloyd Jones forwarded. Civil service reform, the coordination of existing charities to avoid duplication and to restore self-dependence through adequate scientific methods of rehabilitation, the Unitarian Temperance Society, reform of prison administration, the women's rights movement, the American Humane Association. What we know as the World's Fair. The World's Columbian Exposition in 1893 in Chicago included the World Parliament of Religions, a crowning achievement of the exposition. a Presbyterian clergyman was its chief, and Jones its secretary. Although, this is a quote, although to Jones' kindling enthusiasm, the idea owed its realization. Invitations were sent through the State Department to all the nations and religious bodies of the world, asking for assurances of support and for the appointment of official delegates. Favorable replies were received from virtually all those approached. The register of noted prelates, scholars, rabbis, and ministers who came from all parts of the world to Chicago filled 6 pages of the proceedings of the Parliament of Nations. Busy, ubiquitous Secretary Jones, happier than he had ever been before, was given an ovation. To Jones, the Parliament demonstrated clearly the 3 underlying unities of religion: brotherhood, character, reverence. Jenkin Lloyd Jones was adamantly opposed to war. He denounced and resisted the Hearst Hen aggression against Spain and her colonial possessions. That would be the Spanish-American War, which he thought, like the Negro slaves in the South, would better have been purchased at any price than fought over. When Henry Ford invited him to join the peace ship expedition in 1915 to warring countries of Europe, he accepted. His speeches and writings sounded subversive to the Washington authorities after the United States joined the war effort. So a unity lost its mailing privileges in the United States from July 4th to August 19th, 1918. But Jones would not withdraw a word he had written or promise to suppress his pacifist views in future. The extra correspondence and excitement aggravated heart trouble. Finally, the post office relented and released the August 29th edition of Unity. A copy of it reached Jones at Tower Hill on the morning of September 1st. He read it carefully, pointed out the inevitable typographical error, chuckled a bit over his victory, fell into a deep slumber, and died. For his epitaph in the old Welsh burying ground at Tower Hill, he had selected Lincoln's words. He sought to pull up a thistle and plant a flower wherever a flower would grow. But I have seen the gravestone in the family cemetery there at near Taliesin. The words of Robert Browning on the second page of your order of service are carved in stone. Let's read them together. At the bottom of the page. One who never turned his back, but our hearts pressed forward, never doubted the clouds would break, never dreamed the right or worse wrong would triumph, held we fall to rise, our battle to fight better, sleep to wake. But a better idea, now this is from a book called Freedom Moves West by Charles Lytle, which I borrowed from First Unitarian Society. A better idea of what a visit of Secretary Jones would mean to a little group of liberals in a raw young city on the great western plains, beaten down by bank and crop failures, or to a lonely, poorly paid minister in a reactionary environment. Here are words about Jones from W.G. Gannett. William Channing Gannett. One voice whose bell shall ring away all fear, one hand in which we grasp incarnate cheer, one steadfast smile rayed out with eyes alight to make men say, he's come, now all is right. Preparing for this morning's sermon, I wrote a request. I've told you about this already. Feel free to help yourself. For our closing words, please turn to number 456 in our hymn book. Now, Jones is surely a Welsh name, but look below that reading first and read to yourself silently 458, another Welsh writer's words. And that man is still living today and one of the people who responded to me. Royal Jones. The one that we're going to read aloud is 456. But below that, read 458. We extinguish this flame, but not the light of the truth,
the warmth of the community, or the fire of commitment. These we carry in our hearts until we are together again.
Baskets around and then ask for prayer announcements.
Is today a prayer fire deadline?
Yes, first of the month. So today is a prayer fire deadline. There is a choir rehearsal next Sunday. There was none.
All the posters that are announcing the party next week, I've taken down just to make us look more the day for my service last night. But next week, next Saturday, is the Prairie Intergenerational Party and potluck. And so we invite you to come now. Sometimes people are hesitant to come to places they don't know what's happening. But read. We need to just trust them. We are going to have a good time. If you don't know what's happening, just come anyway.
And that starts at 6. The potluck starts at 6 o'clock here. I hope you can all come.
The Arab American Cultural Center of Madison is sponsoring a demonstration next Saturday, the 7th. At the Capitol from 12 to 1 o'clock. And it's a peace parade and rally, but not bombing the wreck. The contact person is Nasser Abu Fahad, and I have his telephone number if anybody wants to talk to him or call him. And this was given out last night at the Women's International League. Potluck, where a speaker, Professor Douglas, an Iraqi, spoke, which is why I wasn't here to the celebration that Jack was here. So anyway, there's a really strong movement to continue the anti-war demonstrations, and I urge any of you to come at noon next Saturday on the Capitol steps.
Most of you who've been to the Prairie Service Auction in the past few years know how much fun it's been and how much money has been raised for Prairie. And my co-auctioneer has been Reed Miller, who's not able to do it this year, but I have a new co-auctioneer. I'm very pleased that Rick Owens has agreed to allow the Prairie Service. I don't know if Eileen wants to make an announcement. We'll be having a call for donations coming up soon, and the service auction is Sunday.
Already, right now.
Okay. Sunday, March 22nd, there'll be pizza after the service, and a good time is promised for all. I'm sure Rick and I will make a good team on that.
Give your donations to Nikki or Ken. And if you want to bring food, let me know.
Okay.
When you retire, sell your house and buy a motorhome, you've got nothing better to do but send 5-page emails. I don't know if anybody else got this from Dick Bonsack. For those of you that didn't, I'm going to put it out the back there. They will be back here on April 14th. There's some place between Florida and here. And Dick apparently is having eyelid surgery April 14th, and when he's recovered, they're heading out to the West Coast. Such a deal.
I received an email at work from the Department of Public Instruction about a holiday I've never heard of, which probably some of you have heard of, Myra Sadker Day, March 5th, a national effort to break gender barriers, and it tells us about the person and a bunch of activities that all posted.
Now, Robin is doing an observance of that person downstairs in spirit service.
Yeah, I gave him the word on it.
See, there was another hand back here, Al.
It took a little while for recognition to occur, but what we were reading as our last reading today is a former member of Prairie Square.
Other
announcements? Herbert Bachelor Zingler from Milwaukee is speaking next Sunday, and it'll be, I guess, in the next prayer. But I thought I mentioned it because you're talking about animal rights and this that fits in with the two hunting programs that we have.
Thank you, Mary. Where is she speaking? Any other announcements? Amazing.
I have a sorrow, but I guess I missed the other joys and sorrows like earlier. I've been in a relationship with a woman for on and off for 2 years. She's grown to be my best friend, and she just recently got into coke. The only thing I can do is either watch her go down, or else just not be there and all for her. I don't know what to do, because I feel like I don't really have anyone else like as a best friend, you know. So that's my
good thing to talk to somebody about. I would join, since we've already had our closing words, I would invite you to join us for coffee and socialize now. Mm-hmm.